Have a seat. This morning we're continuing on in the book of John. And if you have a Bible, you can open it to John chapter 3. Last week we talked about Jesus meeting up with Nicodemus and being challenged to be born again, to start new, to start fresh, and to have a whole new start with God. And we talked about that and what that means. Now today we're going to look at John the Baptist again. I know we talked about him a number of weeks ago when he was baptizing Jesus. And baptism is that, you know, for baptism for the people, when John was baptizing people, he was telling people to turn from their sins. It was like a new turning to God. For Jesus, the baptism that John did for Jesus was to start and inaugurate his ministry and to start it all off. Today, what baptism means in light of the cross, Jesus' death and resurrection, is that it actually symbolizes both a cleansing from our sin that God has done through his son on the cross and a coming back to life again. That's kind of coming out of the water. And so if you haven't been baptized before, I would encourage you, but you've made that decision to follow Jesus, this is the next step. Jesus says, believe and be baptized. And we have this seminar that's going to be going on next Saturday, a class, an hour and a half, to find out more about it. Maybe this is your time to get baptized and to say, yeah, God, I believe in you, and I'm following you, and this is giving evidence to everybody that, yes, I've been cleansed and I'm starting new. So this is about baptism, it goes on. From there, verse 22 of John chapter 3, it says, Then Jesus and his disciples left Jerusalem and went into the Judean countryside, and Jesus spent some time with them there, baptizing people. At this time, John the Baptist was baptizing at Enon near Salim, because there was plenty of water there, and people kept coming to him for baptism. This was before John was thrown into prison. And a debate broke out between John's disciples and a certain Jew over ceremonial cleansing. So John's disciples came to him and said, Rabbi, the man you met on the other side of the Jordan, the one you identified as the Messiah, is also baptizing people, and everybody is going to him instead of coming to us. And John replied, No one can receive anything unless God gives it to him from heaven. You yourselves know how plainly I told you, I'm not the Messiah. I'm only here to prepare the way for him. It is the bridegroom who marries the bride, and the best man is simply glad to stand with him and hear his vows. Therefore, I am filled with joy at his success. He must become greater and greater, and I must become less and less. He has come from above and is greater than anyone else. We are of the earth, and we speak of earthly things, but he has come from heaven and is greater than anyone else. He testifies about what he has seen and heard, but how few believe what he tells them. Anyone who accepts his testimony can affirm that God is true, for he is sent by God. He speaks God's words, for God gives him the Spirit without limit. The Father loves his Son and has put everything into his hands. And anyone who believes in God's Son has eternal life. Anyone who doesn't obey the Son will never experience eternal life, but remains under God's angry judgment. So we have some words here. This is actually, you know, for John the Baptist, we don't get a whole lot on him. There's not a long story on him. There's not a lot of stories of situations and things like this. This is actually the longest we ever see him talk. And yet, it's interesting what Jesus said about him. And an interesting question to have around the dinner table sometime is to ask the question, who is, except for Jesus, if you're a Christ follower, you believe that Jesus is the greatest human that ever lived, but born of a woman, or born, you know, naturally, who is the greatest person who ever lived? I know that question was put to us as Canadians a while back ago, wasn't it? Who's the greatest Canadian? We love our Terry Fox, don't we? He really embodies an incredible symbol of courage and strength. Well, you know what? Jesus answered that question 2,000 years ago. And for someone, God himself, Jesus, who knows everything about history, it's very interesting that he named John the Baptist. He said in Matthew 11, verse 11, he said, among those born of women, he says, there is no one greater There's no one greater than John the Baptist. Now think about that for a moment. Because Jesus skipped over Abraham, the father of faith. He skipped over Moses, the great deliverer. He left out David, man after his own heart. Rugged guy, humble, shepherd, great warrior. He bypassed Daniel, most powerful, influential man in two great empires, a great prophet. Skipped Noah, Samuel, Solomon, and then any other secular heroes that there might be. And he named one guy who was actually living in his day. And he says, John. And I find it so interesting that we don't even get that much on John. We just know that he was out there baptizing. But I think we can look into this passage and what John says and get a picture into his heart. And Jesus, who knows every person's heart, he knew that John was a guy who described and understood greatness from a whole different perspective than oftentimes what we do. I'm a big sports fan, and I know this last week, you know, I'm not even a big baseball fan, but anybody get, like, really involved in this baseball World Series this last week? Okay, we're not big baseball fans overall here in Canada, but maybe we're all still tired from watching the Canucks last year. But I mean, pretty epic. And you know, there's words used like greatest, greatest game, great, great, great. And we throw around words of greatness, right? But Jesus wasn't just throwing out the word great here. He was measuring it on a different scale. And he said, you know, even though John was just seemed like a pretty common guy, actually, you know, he wore camel's hair. He didn't really have a great image. He wasn't with the rich and famous. He often confronted people and even offended people. But Jesus called him great. So here he did have a crowd. He did have people coming to him, people getting, you know, hearing from him. Didn't have a great leadership position. It was just kind of influence. He had influence. And then Jesus, he's over in Galilee, you know, and I talked about the turning water into wine, and he's doing ministry over in another neighborhood across the Jordan River in Galilee. And it says at the beginning of this passage, he says, he went over into the Judean countryside. Now that's John's turf. That's his neighborhood. That's where he's kind of the big guy, the main show. And they look, and it says the disciples got his followers. So John had his own kind of set of people who were loyal to him and kind of gathering around him and everything. And every rabbi sort of had that back in the day. They had these traveling rabbis. And they said to John the Baptist, they said, everybody is going to him instead of coming to us. It's starting to get them a little ticked off. And, you know, the writer of this passage actually kind of highlights it by saying he was baptizing people in Anon near Salim. And what Anon means is fountain, and what Salim means is peace. So there was this fountain of peace happening. But it wasn't happening for the disciples of John. John's disciples were going, we're not feeling good about this at all. This is like right here. He's doing the same thing you are. He's baptizing people. Come on, what's up with that? And, you know, sometimes you think about that, something could have happened in John's heart and going, yeah, what is up with that? Our people are leaving us? We're not the main show anymore? Our influence is dwindling. It's going over to someone else. Has there been a time in your life when you felt like, why is it flowing everywhere but my way? I think we all get that sometimes. We all get that sense of, you know, why is somebody else getting recognition and I'm getting looked over in my job? Or why is it going so well for that person, you know, with success and with finances? And it just seems to be flowing towards them. And I think we all want to be great in some way. If not, we might not have visions of grandeur and want, you know, big crowds following us. It might not be a part of our personality at all. We might not want the spotlight on us. But all of us want things to go great in some way or another. And when it doesn't, oftentimes we're going, what's up? Like, it's going somewhere else. Or why does that person's family it seems to just work out for them? Why does that person get into that friendship group? Or why did they get that talent and I got this? Or why did they get those looks and I get this? Whatever it is, we oftentimes kind of end up in that place where we start kind of going, just like these disciples, what's happening here, God? And there's something that kind of starts working in our lives, and some jealousies, some envy kind of starts rising. And there's something ugly called pride that just sort of starts welling up. If we're really honest, it affects all of us. It was the initial sin, and it still is there in some way or another. We want to be kind of the center. We want it to kind of flow our way. And here we have John saying, he must get greater, I must become less. He wasn't grasping at greatness. He didn't go for it. And there's an incredible humble spirit there that actually attracts people in a powerful way. I think all of us can look at that and go, yeah, we get repulsed when it seems like, you know, somebody who has it all, they've achieved greatness in a field, but they know it, you know, and they don't treat people very well. We're kind of repulsed by that. Like, she thinks she's all that, or he's so full of himself, kind of a thing. And yet sometimes we know that that there is kind of in us, and we want kind of more, and we're not getting that. And you got to think that the disciples of John are thinking, I don't know, this is kind of our livelihood, and this was our main thing, this is our gig, and it's maybe going past us. But John shows this incredible humility. I heard a talk on humility recently by a guy named John Dixon. He was an Australian, and he talked about how beautiful and attractive humility is. Like, when a person, you know, it actually was a fairly new concept. In ancient Roman world, to achieve and then to be better and to be above, like the whole idea of humility and serving others and coming under others, he actually kind of extrapolated on that and said, you know, it was Jesus Christ and the cross that changed society, where we actually find it incredibly attractive. Even in whether you're a Christ follower or not, you find it attractive when somebody just doesn't kind of glory over others. And that's a Christianity influenced thing around the world. And I found it interesting reading in our local newspaper, The Now, this last week, about the Bush and Clinton summit, the economic summit that happened here in Surrey. And it says here, one of the editors for The Now was there, and he says, for being two of the world's most powerful men, Bill Clinton and George Bush seemed downright down to earth Thursday afternoon. You can see, and essentially what this author went after is that, well, he says, their humor and anecdotes and sometimes eloquent, and he says, what they loved about it was the sense of humor that was there. And he kind of scores each of them. He says, I know they're friends now, but who wins on the whole deal? And interesting enough, he put Bush winning in a bunch of areas. But he says, sense of humor, it has to go to Bush. This one goes to Bush, hands down. It's no secret that the Texan has a certain charm with audiences, but he outdid himself in Surrey. In fact, the very first words out of his mouth were funny. And then he went on to talk about self-deprecating jokes. And he says, Bush had the crowd howling several times at his own expense. After explaining his theory on debt and creating jobs, Bush stopped almost mid-sentence. He says, maybe people can't quite explain it quite as articulately as I can. And, you know, that made everybody laugh because, you know, everybody makes fun of Bushisms and his way of talking and how, you know, mixed up and vague he kind of gets when he tries to talk. Bush got the biggest laugh of the day when he mentioned his book, which he's written called Decision Points. And he says, this is what Bush said. He says, of course, you probably haven't read it. He said, in fact, people in Vancouver didn't think I could read, much less write. So, he kind of knows what's sort of out there about him. And there was something incredibly attractive about that. And that's what John Dixon mentioned in his talk on humility. It's actually something that's beautiful and generative and persuasive and inspiring. And it was Jesus who actually said that the last shall be first and the first shall be last. And he was pointing to this whole way of living that says, you know what, there's something bigger and something greater than me. And John epitomized that in the greatest way in this talk. And so I want to look at three different kind of phrases that John used in his response to his disciples and say, you know, how does that apply to our lives? And ultimately, how do we become great? And maybe it should be instead said, how do we become least? Because we know that in God's kingdom, everything's topsy-turvy. And it's actually upside down. And the least are the greatest, and the greatest are the least. And so we get these great truths from John's response. And the first one that I see, there's this phrase in there in John 3, verse 27 that says, no one can receive anything unless God gives it from heaven. And the great truth there is reminding ourselves that anything that we have is actually given to me by God. That we look at our lives and just look at it as a gift. And rather than saying, you know, somebody else has got more, somebody else, we go, you know what, my talent, my career, my success, my influence, my position, my leadership, my status, my wealth, my family, or lack of it, is something that is given to me by God. And when we start to look at it, like John said, and said, you know what, you don't get anything unless God has given it to you. The very breath that you breathe, it's given at God's pleasure. And everyone at some time or another feels that they've been overlooked or ignored or underappreciated, unjustly passed over for promotion or honor. And it's hard sometimes to see others succeed. But at the end of the day, it's going to verses like in Psalm 75 where it says, not from the east, not from the west, nor from the desert comes exaltation, but God is the judge. He puts down one and exalts another. Somehow God knows. And it's essential to know this when we're just struggling to be great, to go, you know what, God, what you've given me, I'm content and I'm happy. And you've given me the gift of where I am. Whatever I'm at, that's been given from God. And we can escape so many jealousies and resentfulness when we know that the place that we've been given, our gifts, our position, our influence, that it's been given by God. And God raises up certain people at certain times and in certain ways. I'm going to be content just to say, God, I just celebrate the place that you've given me. I celebrate my unique gifts. I celebrate the role that I'm given. And when we do that, something changes inside. And we actually realize that, you know what, they aren't my gifts. It isn't my role. It isn't, well, for John, it wasn't his crowd anyhow. It was God's. And it changes things. It's liberating. It's humbling. And it actually puts us more in a place of thankfulness when we go, God, it's all a gift. We're coming up to Christmas soon, and that's the whole picture of Christmas, is that we're given gifts. And when we realize that our lives, no matter what place we find ourselves in, it's just a gift. The air that we breathe, every day that we have, is just a gift. John had that perspective. He somehow lived with that. He says, no one can receive anything unless it comes from God in heaven. And we so easily lose that. We think, it's my gift. It's my thing. It's what, this is, you know, my, whatever it is, my job, my position, my influence, my family. So remind ourselves. We have to continue to remind ourselves that. This is always a process. Number two is to learn to simply be glad to serve God's plan. John used an illustration about a wedding and being a best man at a wedding. And he says this phrase, he says, the best man is simply glad to stand with him. That's with the groom. You know, we think about how ridiculous it would be if the best man or the maid of honor or the bridesmaids or whatever make the wedding all about them. We know inherently that when it comes to a wedding, it's like, it's about the bride and the groom. Like, that's where the attention should flow. And John had that perspective on all of life. He was saying, if the attention can go towards God and his plan, then I'm just happy with that. I'm going to simply get out of the way. And the illustration that he's using is that of a best man at a wedding. And the best man at a Jewish wedding, I guess the Hebrew word for that is that he was the shoshban. And he had a unique place. It was a much bigger role than what we have today. He acted as a liaison between the bride and the bridegroom. He arranged the wedding. Can you imagine? Girls, that would be scary for many of you, wouldn't it? To think about the best man planning the wedding for you. He knew he was the MC at the wedding feast. He brought the bride and the bridegroom together. And he had one special duty. And when you think about the purity and the sacredness of marriage and God's ideal that even the first night, your wedding night is your first night. He was the actual guy who would like guard the bridal chamber. And when you think about at night, when the there's no electricity, he's the guy who's like listening for the groom's voice. He goes, okay, I'll let you in. Only you. And that was his job. And as he walked away, he goes, I did that with joy. That was awesome. I set it up. It's done. And that's John's perspective. He said, you know, I was just here to set things up for God. And in our lives, if we look at the plan of our lives and we say, actually, you know what, God, if I trust you and know that you've given me these gifts and that your plan is good, I'm just part of a bigger plan. Whatever's going on in my job, in my family, in my friendships, in what I have, is just part of what you've given for this grand plan that you have, which is ultimately going to end up with a wedding feast after this life. And we recognize that our place is just to go there to set things up for God and say, God, now you be great. There's this new kingdom to be lived in. And when we live in the zone that John the Baptist lived in, It's a world of love and grace and humility and beauty. It's a completely kind of different way of living. And the invitation that John makes to his disciples, really to his followers, is come and live that with me. I'm simply glad to get out of the way, to serve God's plan, to get out of the way. And what I ultimately want to see is people come into a relationship with God, to get right with God. And when we begin to define our lives as being much more about how do we set things up so in our relationships, in the way that we love others, we're just setting it up so that somehow they can make a connection with God. It might be for the first time. It might be to see that love flow again. We're just getting it. We're just setting things up for God to be in relationship with others. Simply glad. It makes life simple, and there's a joy in that. And then in verse 30, he makes the classic statement. He must become greater and greater, and I must become less and less. Always point at someone who's much greater than me or any created thing. Now that's when you think about John competing with God, it's a little bit crazy. And, you know, he had a very, like, he understood and he had a big picture of who Jesus was, that he was actually the Son of God. That was revealed to him at the baptism. And for him to think, I'm this big and I'm going to be, like, competing with, like, God, it's ridiculous. And he knew that. And he stepped out of the way and he said, you know what, I know that he's just going to get greater and greater. As Jesus' ministry goes on and his ultimate self-humiliation, dying on a cross, that this is going to be something that's talked about 2,000 years from now. It's going to be talked about forever because it's the most greatest illustration of humility we've ever seen. He must become greater and greater, and I must become less and less. You know, sometimes we take that and we kind of distort it a little bit, and we think maybe that means that we must have to think very low of ourselves, or somehow get really down on ourselves. And I love how, and sometimes that in itself can be a lie, because actually when we live great lives, when we live lives of influence, when we use all of our gifts and talents, it can't possibly diminish God. Because if we realize how small those are really compared to God, all it does is point to a greater God who's up there. And I love the book by C.S. Lewis. It's called The Screwtape Letters, and it's a satire. It's written with a lot of wit, and it's dedicated to J.R. Tolkien, his friend. And the gist of it is, it's a group of letters that are written from a senior devil to a junior devil who's working on a young man who's become a Christ follower to try and tempt him and bring him down. And so it's this older devil, and it's just an interesting kind of plot where he's always sending these letters to Wormwood. And that's the name of the junior devil, and the older devil is Screwtape. And there's lots of humor in here, but it actually really brings out a lot of insights about how our mind and psyche works. And I'll read this the letter on pride and humility that Screwtape sends Wormwood. He says, the most alarming thing in your last account of the patient, that's the young guy that he's working on, okay, you're working on, is that he's making none of those confident resolutions which marked his original conversion. No more lavish promises of perpetual virtue, I gather, but even the expectation of an endowment of grace for life, but only a hope for the daily and hourly pittance to meet the daily and hourly temptation. This is very bad. I see only one thing to do at the moment. Your patient has become humble. Have you drawn his attention to the fact? All virtues are less formidable to us once the man is aware that he has them, but this is especially true of humility. Catch him at the moment when he is really poor in spirit and smuggle into his mind the gratifying reflection, by Jove, I'm being humble. And almost immediately pride at his own humility will appear, for he awakes to the danger and tries to smother this new form of pride. Make him proud of his attempt. And so on, through as many stages as you please. But don't try this too long, for fear you awake his sense of humor and proportion, in which case he will merely laugh at you and go to bed. But there are other profitable ways of fixing his attention on the virtue of humility. By this virtue, as by all others, our enemy, that's refers to God, wants to turn the man's attention away from self and to him. and to the man's neighbors. All the abjection and self-hatred are designed in the long run solely for this end. Unless they attain this end, they do us little harm, and they may even do us good if they keep the man concerned with himself, and above all, if self-contempt can be made the starting point for contempt of other selves, and thus for gloom, cynicism, and cruelty. You must therefore conceal from the patient the true end of humility. Let him think of it not as self-forgetfulness, I love that word, what true humility is self-forgetfulness, but as a certain kind of opinion, namely a low opinion of his own talents and character. Some talents, I gather, he really has. Fix in his mind the idea that humility consists in trying to believe those talents to be less valuable than he believes them to be. No doubt they are, in fact, less valuable than he believes, but that is not the point. The great thing is to make him value an opinion for some quality other than truth, thus introducing an element of dishonesty and make-believe into the heart of what otherwise threatens to become a virtue. By this method, thousands of humans have been brought to think that humility means pretty women trying to believe they are ugly and clever men trying to believe they are fools. And since that is what they are trying to believe may in some cases be manifest nonsense, they cannot succeed in believing it, and we have the chance of keeping their minds endlessly revolving on themselves in an effort to achieve the impossible. To anticipate the enemy, that's God's strategy, we must consider his aims. The enemy, that's God, wants to bring the man to a state of mind in which he could design the best cathedral in the world and know it to be the best and rejoice in the fact without being any more or less or otherwise glad at having done it himself than he would be if it had been done by another. The enemy wants him in the end to be so free from any bias in his own favor that he can rejoice in his own talents as frankly and gratefully as his neighbor's talents, or in a sunrise, an elephant, or a waterfall. He wants each man in the long run to be able to recognize all creatures, even himself, as glorious and excellent things. He wants to kill their animal self-love as soon as possible, but it is his long-term policy, I fear, to restore to them a new kind of self-love, a charity and gratitude for all selves, including their own. When they have really learned to love their neighbors as themselves, they will be allowed to love themselves as their neighbors. For we must never forget what is the most repellent and inextricable trait in our enemy, that's in God. He really loves the hairless bipeds he has created and always gives back to them with his right hand what he has taken away with his left. There's an interesting kind of insight into the kind of God that looks at us and says, you know, I know your smallness. I know your frailty. I know your weakness. I know your propensity towards self-love. And yet, I love you. That's what God says about us. And I very much want to use you in my kingdom. And making God great does not mean making ourselves less. It means just pointing the way and saying, you know what? It's all towards God. And then John does that in the following verses. And I'm going to start with verse 36 because he talks about how God... there's this justice of God. There's this angry judgment that God has against anything that is done to diminish and to put down other people. And I love how God talks about it. What it's talking about here in this anger that God has, it's like a passionate expression of outrage against wrongdoing. It's just God looking at things and getting passionate and in a very measured way, in a very controlled and deliberate way, saying, I'm going to deal with that. And ultimately, at the end of the day, we want God to deal with what's wrong. I know sometimes people have a real hard time with God's wrath and his judgment, but in the end of the day, if we know that he is ultimately just, and he is ultimately loving and ultimately good, he will set things right. There's a movie I went to recently, and I found myself maybe one of the only men in the theater, but it was really good, and I'd recommend it to anybody, whether you're a man or a woman, and it's called The Help. And certainly there's parts of it that are, you know, on the crude side. But what it deals with is the whole idea of racial segregation. And The Help refers to the maids that worked in the homes in the 60s under Jim Crow's segregation laws there in Alabama and the way that they were treated. And you see this kind of just horrific sort of, and it's fictional, but I think it portrays a lot of what is there within the human heart. No matter what color you are. But it follows the life of Skeeter, this journalist who ends up writing a book kind of exposing kind of the racism and the way in which so many of these women are diminished. And Skeeter herself was essentially raised by her maid, who spoke words of life and wisdom and hope into her. And she loved this woman. She goes off to university. She comes back and finds out that this maid that she had looked up to had been dismissed by her mother in order to save face in front of some racist other women. And the kind of outrage that she has. And there's a number of situations in that. And I found myself sitting there watching this movie and going, oh, I am so angry at those people with their self-righteousness and what they're doing to these people. And there's this brilliant scene at the end where one of these maids is brought into a table and given a feast by a white couple. And I think it's an incredible picture of God setting things right. And I think we all want that. We want God to make things right. And so that's what God's justice is about. That's what John is pointing to here, where he's saying, you know what, God's justice is much bigger than ours. And if we try and figure it out and know how he's all going to do that and all the details, we can't. He's got a much greater justice than ours. He must get greater, we must become less. We're going to just trust him to do what is right. He points to a greater power. He talks about a God who is powerful in verse 31. And like I said before, it's like to his disciples, do you know who you're competing with here? We're earthly creatures. We're like ants. And this is God coming from heaven. We're setting ourselves up against the Alpha and Omega here. And so he points to a greater power. He points to a greater knowledge. He talks about a God who knows all things. And ultimately, if we want information about something, we go to the first-hand person that has the information. And John's saying, Jesus has that. He has the knowledge. He alone can tell us the facts. He can tell us the truth. And in verse 33, he says, God is true. And he points to the fact that, you know, everybody else's relative truth or their idea of truth, it can't compare with a God from heaven. He talks about greater words. He talks about how his words are true and his words are good. And you look at talks that Jesus gave, like the Sermon on the Mount, and you say, you can't improve on that. It was the words of life. Love your neighbor as yourself. He gave so many words that are absolutely life-giving and powerful because the Spirit is in them. I love the story of Billy Graham. He was a great speaker and preacher from the last generation. But he was in an elevator, and his friend Graham Keith tells about standing there with him. And because he's so recognizable in that era, a guy in the elevator looks at him and says, you're Billy Graham, aren't you? And Billy Graham goes, yes. And he says, well, he says, you are truly a great man, he said to him. And Billy Graham responded by saying, I'm not a great man. I just have a great message. And, you know, that's ultimately, as Christ followers, we just kind of pass on the words of Jesus. They aren't original with us. And there's power in that. And John recognized that. And he said, his words are truth. His words are great. And then he refers to a God who loves his son. A God who actually is himself dying for us. And he points to that. And it's not about decreasing self. It's about just increasing God and saying, you know what? There's a God. Pointing people to that. Saying there's something great that has been done for us. And I really, one of the things that kind of won us over to this new logo as a church is that it has the cross inside the arrow. And it's pointing up to God. And it's pointing forward as well. And it's ultimately, no matter as individuals or as a church, it's not about us. It's not about even the church. It's about Jesus. It's about pointing people and saying, you know what, there's something that's been done for you that will humble you, will change your focus. You'll recognize that there's a bigger plan to your existence, to your life. And at the end of the day, when you recognize the greatness of God, you're simply glad to say, you know what, it's about him. This is like his wedding. This life is about him. And he's going to get greater. And in the process, I'll become less, but I'm just thankful to do that. He's simply amazing, is really what it's about. John recognized that. Jesus said he was the greatest that ever lived. He is justice, he is power, he is knowledge, he is truth, he is words of life, and he's got this amazing love for us. And as we go this week, we can say, you know what, God, I want to live that out in my life. I want you to be greater. Maybe that's a kind of something you say in your own heart. I want to kind of realign my trajectory. I want to look at things in a new way. I want to appreciate the gifts that God's given me. to just appreciate that they're not mine, they're just given from God. I want to look at it and say, you know, I'm stepping aside for God. I just ultimately want to point people to Jesus. That's a worthwhile goal. That's a worthwhile plan for our lives. I want to invite you to stand, and we'll close in prayer.